Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and listen to this.
Just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people. We've entered this evil alliance of America against the Islamic State to back off and leave our people alone.
How does this garbled voice of the man known as Jihadi John, and now identified by journalists as Mohammed Emwazi from West London, now a figure in the self-proclaimed Islamic State, we'll talk more about what that means in just a moment, but how does this man's voice on an ISIS terror video say, hey, come join the fun here in Syria, to teenagers around the world? As we will discuss this hour, it's a sophisticated pitch way beyond the voice of Jihadi John through social media infiltrating teenagers at their most vulnerable, where running away from home seems like a solution to alienation from parents and no apparent options or future, moments when dreamy romance seems attractive and dropping out is not destructive. It's heroic. This is the call from ISIS on social media and in online videos, an allure of the forbidden that has found eager adherents. The three teenage girls from London who fled their homes last week and are now believed to be in Syria. The men from Brooklyn, New York, apprehended this week trying to get to Syria to join up. It's believed that more than 500 women from Western cities had heeded a call to join the jihad and live in the self-proclaimed caliphate of ISIS, many hundreds more men. Sarah Khan is the director of Inspire, a counter-extremism and women's human rights organization in the UK. She recently wrote a passionate open letter to young Muslims as a counter-rhythm to the drumbeat of ISIS, which has terrified her as a woman, as an advocate, and as a Muslim.
I genuinely believe that this is a grooming issue. I mean, these three girls from East London were the ages of 15 and 16, and ISIS very much groom these kind of girls. You see how older jihadi men are going on social media sites. They're talking to these girls, asking them about their height, you know, their weight, how pretty they are. And then on top of that, you find that there are female ISIS recruiters who are also grooming them, encouraging them to come over. So it's a radicalization process, but it's also very much a grooming process as well.
Well, I know lots of teenage girls, and, you know, my kids talk about, you know, all kinds of things as teenage girls, but I've never heard them talk about clashes of civilization and ideology and narratives of ISIS. They're the kinds of things that would motivate them would be much more personal, and I'm just wondering how ISIS intervenes in this sort of personal dimension of a 15-year-old that would make them say, you know, my life just really sucks here. But somehow going over to Syria and not bathing for months and getting married to someone I don't even know and participating in ISIS is an alternative.
No, and it's a very important question. I think it's really important to understand that there is no single route to becoming radicalized. There is no single profile that fits a person who becomes radicalized. And that's something that we've learned actually since 9/11. You know, we know that people who are educated, people who are, you know, who are doctors, people who are not educated, you know, you have the whole range of people who become radicalized. I think when you look at young people in the UK who are attracted to ISIS ideology, I think some of it is personal. I mean, I know of people who've perhaps their parents have got divorced and that's really impacted on them. And there's a void there and they're looking for someone to fill that void. And sometimes that extremist narrative appeals to them. But it's also, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the successful recruitment drive of ISIS. I mean, if you look at some of their videos, they're incredibly powerful. You have a powerful, charismatic preacher using religion as a driving tool. You know, I mean, what more authority can you have if you're saying God sanctions what I'm doing? And then also kind of using very emotive pictures, Syrian children being killed, for example, or showing how, you know, Western countries are maybe bombing countries like Iraq and the aftermath and the pictures of that, using powerful music to stir emotions. I mean, they are very powerful, moving videos and propaganda of ISIS. And I don't think we should underestimate how powerful that is.
How does social media seed this in the sense that, okay, let's say a dozen 15-year-old girls find their way to Syria, but then they have connections to other girls back in the UK and they describe their situation and all of a sudden this network of girls is being pitched in a way that parents can't get to, that there's really no way to get into that conversation because this is girl-to-girl conversation. How does that work?
I mean, it's very difficult, and you really have to feel for the parents because, you know, many of these parents will not know what their kids are viewing online, and that's with anything. You know, we live in an era now where, you know, kids have got smartphones, they've got access to absolutely everything. They've got the internet on their fingertips, and that's one of the dangers of the internet. As much positivity is there about the internet, it also has and harbours dangerous sites that can you know, make people do all sorts of things. I mean, it's what's interesting about ISIS is that they use women in particular, female ISIS recruiters who target young girls. And what they do is that they paint a very romanticized image of life in ISIS. So, you know, they paint this image of the hundreds of women have come across from all parts of the world, from different countries have come on it. There's this huge sisterhood in ISIS and it's wonderful and life is amazing. And they really present this utopian aspect to it. And I think a lot of girls, particularly 15-year-old girls, really incredibly naive. They don't realize this kind of propaganda, and they fall for it. So just as an example, one young girl who left East London last week, there's Shamima Begum, for example. She, if you look at her Twitter account and you see who she's following, all the people she is following are ISIS fighters or female ISIS recruiters. And so her whole, you can see how she's being fed this kind of picture about ISIS life and what a lot of these ISIS fighters and ISIS female recruiters are doing are painting this picture of how wonderful it is. And they give advice on how to get here, how to get past the Turkey-Syria border, what kind of things you should bring with you. And they develop a long-term relationship, which is very similar to what online groomers do. You know, they build that trust. They, you know, suggest that they're somebody that you can trust and build a relationship. And they buy that trust of young people. And unfortunately, some of our young people fall for it.
Sarah, with all due respect then, with all that you've described and just how these dynamics are working, how can an open letter that you've written here possibly go up against that? And I'm wondering if you could read a section of it to just give me a sense of how you're trying to get into this conversation. The second to the last paragraph, you write, "Your mother, who for years raised and nurtured you to enable you to achieve great things." You're trying to get them to remember that person who maybe they have a difficult relationship with, but still represents something. Can you give me the tone in which you think a 15-year-old girl might actually connect with what you're saying?
I mean, it's an emotional appeal. It's very much going for the heartstrings and saying, this is your mother, and what you're going to be doing is leaving behind a woman who sacrificed so much for you, and you're going to leave her with a broken heart. Is that something you really want to do? And then obviously I end that paragraph by saying, because there's a very famous saying by the Prophet Muhammad where he says, you know, your mother, she's the most, you know, one of the most important people in your life. You must show so much respect to her. And it's a very well-known saying of the Prophet that Muslims all across the world will know. And my point there is trying to say, you know, no matter how little or how much understanding of Islam you have, that's something you cannot just come back and, you know, there's no argument with that point. And so by saying, well, ISIS are asking you to turn your back on those, on your parents. I mean, many of these girls have left. They refuse to even say goodbye to their parents. Because they think that must be that they're doing something for the pleasure of God. And so the point I'm trying to put here is that ISIS completely violates even the most basic teachings of Islam.
Sarah Khan is director of Inspire, a counter-extremism and women's human rights organization in the United Kingdom. Sarah Khan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Adam Goldman, a reporter for The Washington Post. Adam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
On all of these stories, the identity of the so-called Jihadi John, the pitch to young people around the UK and the world, how quickly is this moving, would you say, as a news story and as people react to it in the United Kingdom and in households in Brooklyn, New York?
It's clearly moving swiftly around the world, and we knew it would. You know, it's being reported now by almost every major media outlet, and it's, of course, a major story in the United States and London and even Japan because of what Jihadi John did to two Japanese hostages.
Is the naming of this fellow an intelligence coup, or does it simply give a name to something that's really not going to change that much?
I don't know if it'll change that much. You know, I was personally driven because while the U.S. and British intelligence agencies and probably the French, too, didn't want him disclosed, you know, it seemed like he didn't deserve anonymity. The FBI director, James B. Comey, said in September they knew who he was. Obviously, Jihadi John knows who he was. So I think it was in the public interest to learn who this individual was or is.
So what do we know? Is he someone who was recruited, who was turned in some way, or is his radicalization something that's been longstanding?
It seems like it was the radicalization was a slow burn. You know, he went on a supposed safari to Tanzania in 2009, but got stopped by the Tanzanian authorities. He was later interrogated by MI5, who asked him whether he wanted to go to Somalia, I guess with the purpose of joining Al-Shabaab. He denied that. And then he comes back to the UK and he moves to Kuwait and he comes back again. He gets interrogated by the authorities in 2010 and he tries to go back to Kuwait where he says he has a bride waiting and essentially he's put on their version of the no-fly list. You know, we have his emails. He wrote that he had written to a friend and he talks about being stuck in London. He felt like he was in a cage. London was his prison. So clearly there was desperation and he wanted to get out of London. One thing that was I found while reporting this is he was obsessed with Al-Shabaab, and he made the hostages in Syria, the Western hostages, the U.S. and others, watch videos of Al-Shabaab. So that leads me to believe that perhaps that trip to Tanzania in 2009 wasn't so innocent, because it's very easy to get Tanzania is right below south of Kenya. And then, of course, Somalia is within reach. It's right over the border from Kenya. So he could have been radicalized by as early as 2009.
What's your sense? Is this an individual with a lot of authority within ISIS, or is he something like, you know, the Ryan Seacrest of terrorism?
No, I think that his stature, along with the other men dubbed the Beatles, has grown within the organization. And by last year, you know, his role had evolved, too, when they were holding the prisoners at Raqqa. You know, he wasn't feeding the prisoners. He wasn't some guard. You know, he was coming once a week, I was told, to visit the prisoners. He was making videos of them that they intended to send to the families. I think these guys had a greater role in the organization. They just weren't mere guards.
Do you think he's still communicating with people around the world under some kind of an alias?
I mean, hard to tell. I don't have any information that he is. And that email address I have for him, as well as his cell phone, no longer work.
Adam Goldman is a reporter for The Washington Post on the identity of Jihadi John as an individual by the name of Mohammed Emwazi from West London. Thanks so much, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Later this hour, we're going to take some of these issues and show how, in so many ways, evolution is hard at work. Allergies are growing around the world. Studies show that it's the way we humans live that's making that happen.
Hi, this is Veronica Glidden from St. Paul, Minnesota. And my grandmother would always tell me, you know, we eat a ton of dirt in our lives. Whenever she saw my kids' faces dirty, we are way too concerned about basic bacteria when actually they're exactly what keep us alive.
Hi, this is Sharla calling from Tennessee. I believe that allergies are increasing because of the chemicals and toxins in our food, water, and air supply. It will only continue to worsen unless each individual makes small, significant changes in their daily lives.
Toxins from ISIS to peanuts, the workings of evolutionary biology, later here on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and here's a voice from the Siberia of the Internet, Western Massachusetts.
In order to participate in this show today, I had to actually travel 20 minutes to a neighboring town where they have cable service in order for me to be able to Skype reliably. My other option was to do it in my car outside my local library, which is connected to fiber.
That's Monica Webb, who's trying to change the way people get internet in Western Mass to give the same high quality available to libraries and emergency services and schools to homes and businesses. Monica Webb is chairman and spokesperson for a consumer-led coalition known as Wired West.
As we know today, the internet is a fundamental tool for exchanging goods and services. It's incredibly efficient. It means people can typically work, shop, learn, participate in commerce, and receive services 24/7 from the convenience of their own homes, typically at a lower cost. However, for us here, if you have trouble accessing these services, many of which are only available online, it means we have difficulty here operating home businesses or telecommuting. It means our kids have to sit outside in a car outside the library using the Wi-Fi to do their homework. It means challenges accessing government services. Overall, it means our citizens cannot participate in the tremendous social welfare and economic benefits of having universal and robust internet access.
So what are the problems in specific communities, and how are you attempting to deal with these with your venture called Wired West?
The problem in our communities is clearly we don't have enough coverage, and where there is internet access in the communities, it's typically in the populated centers of town, and it's DSL, which, is really yesterday's dial-up. So the private sector is not going to come in and serve our communities in any way with adequate coverage, with adequate bandwidth to satisfy our needs today and tomorrow. So our communities basically said, this problem has to be solved. How can we do this in a way where it is financially sustainable and where it operates in the best interests of our communities? And that's why we formed Wired West.
And how could the FCC help your venture in any way, as you can tell? Net neutrality, of course, won't affect you specifically, but the principles of net neutrality would certainly affect any service that would come to Western Massachusetts. What could the FCC do to make your job a little bit easier?
So something that is really important that has happened within the FCC in the last year or so is of great benefit to rural areas without broadband. The reason we don't have ubiquitous coverage is it just doesn't meet the private sector's financial metrics for providing broad coverage. So you go back to, well, why is it everyone has phone service? Well, everyone has phone service because of the Universal Service Fund, which is a way to subsidize service in rural areas where it's not profitable for the private sector to offer universal coverage. Now, that fund is being reformed by the FCC into what's called the Connect America Fund. And that will now extend those same benefits of subsidizing service in rural areas to broadband. And the FCC is putting forward a very robust program in order to do that, where they are requiring bandwidth speeds that will set up these communities for decades to come with adequate telecommunications infrastructure. So for our region, that is a very exciting development, because funding has consistently been the challenge in getting these communities wired.
So fingers crossed, but not necessarily holding their breaths up there in Western Massachusetts. Monica Webb, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Monica Webb is chairman and spokesperson for Wired West in Western Massachusetts.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This issue just might drive the Republican race for the White House next year.
The bottom line is that to move our state forward, Wisconsin needs a modern economy. We cannot remain mired in the antiquated system.
Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Republican Scott Fitzgerald, the sponsor of the state's Right to Work bill that will allow people to opt out of union membership and union dues in private sector industries. Those are pro-union protesters trying to prevent a statewide movement from further eroding union power, since Governor Scott Walker led the battle in Wisconsin to roll back public sector union power and even survived a statewide recall vote. As Wisconsin state lawmakers begin debating the so-called Right to Work law, this issue is helping to position Governor Walker as a presidential candidate. Walker became the first GOP presidential hopeful to open an office in Iowa. He's also hired advisors in New Hampshire. Joining us is Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks for having me on.
How is the right to work a state issue, and why does Scott Walker believe it could be a national issue?
Well, it's one of the few areas of private sector labor law where states have some say in how things are run. Most decisions are made at the federal level, but half the states, 24 of them, have put into effect right-to-work states. Scott Walker wants to make us the 25th one. He's made his national reputation on taking on unions. He has really shied away from this issue in the past, but in the recent days has said he's going to sign it. And I think he believes it'll help bolster his credentials with conservatives.
Now, is he reading the tea leaves that suggest there's money in this, in the sense that fundraisers are supporting this as an issue, or has he suddenly found some other kind of argument for embracing this when he was walking away from it only a few months ago?
This appears to be pushed by the legislature. We have Republicans controlling both houses. If right after the elections, the Senate majority leader said he was taking on this issue, he was going to make sure that there would be a debate on this in the first half of 2015. I think Scott Walker knows that, you know, he had no option really other than to sign it.
Do the protests in Wisconsin help Walker, do you think, nationally, or do they give him headaches here in the state of Wisconsin?
Oh, I don't think they're giving him any headaches. I mean, these protests are large by typical standards, but tiny compared to the historic ones we had in 2011. At that time, there were as many as 100,000 people at the state capitol. There were sustained protests for a month. I don't think this is in any way hurting him in a Republican presidential primary. I suppose if he gets the nomination and he goes on, it, you know, hardens opposition against him. So that could be a longer term problem.
Looking at the race, you know, Jeb Bush is very, very familiar, almost boring. Chris Christie is like been there, done that. These are individuals who have huge credibility, but not necessarily a lot of electricity. And then you've got Rand Paul, who's a fringy, and you've got Marco Rubio, who's not necessarily a seasoned candidate. Does Walker see how he stands out from the crowd here? Get into his mind for us.
Walker kind of got on the map in 2011 with these changes to public sector collective bargaining and then the protests they elicited. And then a year later really became a national hero to conservatives because of the attempt to recall him and his ability to become the first governor in the country's history to survive a recall. So he's been around for a while. From the national media's perspective, they seemed not to catch on that he could be a very viable candidate for president until January and his speech in Iowa. And so I think he's only now coming under the scrutiny that, you know, Chris Christie and a Rand Paul and a Ted Cruz have lived through.
Does he want to go the distance?
He's given every appearance that he wants to. I mean, you know, he's set up a 527, which appears to be, for all intents and purposes, a way to test the waters. He's got Operation in Iowa set up. He's got Operation in New Hampshire set up. He's heading to both those states soon. I would be totally shocked if he doesn't run. He is a guy who thinks a lot about campaigns. He's very savvy. He's run for office, you know, basically every 2 years since he's been in his early 20s. If he gets in, which I would suspect that he will have a plan to go as far as he can.
He tests the proposition that he'll either prove it or disprove it, that if you can win the nomination and become the darling of the GOP conservative base, you can't win the general. He can either prove or disprove that proposition this time around.
Maybe. I mean, we'll see. Certainly, I think one of his assets is that he is able to bridge the establishment conservatives and the Tea Party conservatives. And so I think if he were to get the nomination, you wouldn't have the problem you had with Mitt Romney where, you know, a substantial portion of Republicans don't think he's conservative enough, just as if they had nominated someone who's more conservative than Romney, that the establishment Republicans would have been queasy about that. I think with Scott Walker, if he were to get the nomination, that he would be embraced by all parts of the party. And you see that in this early polling. Just the other day, Quinnipiac had a poll out, and, you know, conservatives like him a lot, and very few conservatives don't dislike him. I think his net favorability rating was 50%, which is extremely high. Led the field. This was of Iowa caucus goers. Led the field. So he's really being embraced here.
I don't know what the budgets are like there at the Journal Sentinel, but Are they going to let you follow him all the way, Patrick?
Oh, we have every intention of following him as closely as we can. We have a reporter in Washington, D.C. We've got a team of people who will be following him in Iowa and New Hampshire. We'll be there every step of the way.
Buckle your seatbelts.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Patrick Marley is state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com. TIAA Cref, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second-best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere. In theaters everywhere March 6th.
We're going to push the lens out as wide as we can possibly go right now. We began the hour talking about how technology is enabling the growing encroachment of ISIS in the minds of vulnerable teenagers. Then we spoke about the evolution of our technological life as people insist on having access to the internet as a necessary condition of citizenship. All of these are indications of the sometimes blunt, sometimes nuanced, sometimes brutal human footprint on global life, the often mentioned climate change notwithstanding. A seemingly random detail draws our attention now to how biological evolution is taking place right before our eyes, even if it looks like terrorists would have us step back a few centuries. A report shows that decades-long patterns of avoiding allergens like peanuts, stay with me here, are actually increasing the incidence of allergies by literally changing our biological makeup. How broadly can we apply evolutionary biology to the things we are seeing in the headlines? Juan Enriquez would say it's all evolutionary biology, folks. He's a TED conference luminary and managing director XL Venture of the Harvard Business School Life Sciences Project and co-author of the forthcoming book, Evolving Ourselves, How Unnatural Selection and Non-Random Mutation Are Changing Life on Earth.
The way that what lived and died used to be defined was nature would choose it. And what's happening today is we've become such a powerful species that we choose what lives and dies. So in half of the world, we put our cities, our cows, our dumps, our vacation homes, and we sort of say, okay, we want this kind of bird to survive here and we don't want this kind of bug to survive here. And there are consequences to that.
Explain how the allergies story is a metaphor for this entire process.
So the incidence of allergies, of certain types of allergies, has doubled over the last 10 years and tripled over the last 15 years. And what we're learning now is we can control allergies or we can induce allergies. There was just a study in Australia that talks about how kids whose mothers wash dishes in dishwashers have more allergies than mothers who wash dishes by hand. There's another study that just came out that talks about how if a mother will take peanuts or eat a few peanuts before conception or in the first years of conception or if the child eats peanuts early in their life, then they have a far lower incidence of allergies. So what we're learning is in the measure we control our environment, in the measure we make it unnatural, very good things happen because we've taken ourselves out of the food chain. We are far less prone to infectious disease, and we've doubled our lifespan. But there's also a series of unintended side effects, and some of the symptoms of that may be things like autism, obesity, allergies, much greater height, higher intelligence. There's just a very rapid evolution of our species and of other species.
Would you say that the immune system needs to be in constant contact with noise to be as effective as it can possibly be and that that's something we always need to be mindful of as we control our environment?
Well, it used to be that, you know, if you got measles or you didn't get measles, that could be bad luck, it could be bad air, it could be a divine choice, depending on what your belief system was. But one of the interesting things that's happening is in the measure that we begin to control evolution, it's our choice whether a child comes down with measles. And now we're beginning to learn it's our choice whether you get certain types of allergies or you don't get certain types of allergies. And as we take responsibility for our own evolution, as we understand these things, then yes, allergies are just one harbinger of what happens as we move forward in our environment. And sometimes if we make it too clean, then you get more allergies because our immune system has nothing to attack.
Your book is entitled Evolving Ourselves, which suggests that this evolutionary process is coming under a kind of umbrella of design. But there are certain aspects of this that are well controlled and certain aspects of this that are kind of unforeseen consequences. How do we get better design level control of this process, do you think, as human beings?
I think there's two steps to this. The first step is we have to acknowledge that we're moving into a world where nature is moving from a capital N nature to a small N nature. And humans, through design and through their actions, intended or non-intended, are in charge of the most basic evolution of things. We came close to eliminating measles in the United States until people made a conscious choice to not vaccinate. And in the measure that we do that, in the measure that we choose, I want this kind of a dog, I want this kind of a flower, I want this kind of stuff, we do take control over our own evolution and the evolution of all the things around us.
I suspect you would not want to be categorized as someone who's utopian or, you know, presuming a kind of, nirvana state that we're approaching as humans. You're more sophisticated than that. But there does seem to be a really nuanced sense of optimism in what you're saying. A lot of Hollywood movies, a lot of kind of apocalyptic scenarios out there suggest that we're on the verge of some sort of huge biological snapback, that possibly a microbe will wipe out all of humans or some sort of climate phenomenon will make the world uninhabitable. We had the nuclear situation, of course, during the Cold War. Do you believe that that scenario is out of the picture, even though we haven't solved in any sense all of our problems of the next century or so?
I do tend to be an optimist because if you think of why animals evolve, either their food changes or the diseases change or the climate changes or the circumstances in which they live change, every one of those things has happened to humanity over the last 100 years and 200 years. So we've gone from being a primarily rural species where most of humans lived in the countryside to being an urban species. And the only way you can do that is to reduce violence. Because if you're living in a crowded apartment building next to a series of other crowded apartment buildings, then one of the consequences is you can't have marauding Vikings or Huns or something else running through the center. And if you look at what's happened in our cities, there's still a lot of violence. There's still places that are dangerous. But on the whole, Boston is a whole lot less dangerous. New York is a whole lot less dangerous. Los Angeles is a whole lot less dangerous than it was a few decades ago. The overall trends, I think, are quite positive for humanity.
So I have to ask you this then. How do you view as an evolutionary biologist kind of thought process the phenomenon of ISIS? Is it a flame out of something that is coming to an end, or is it the flicker of something that's beginning that will plague us for a century or so?
I think the things that ISIS is doing are inexcusable and horrifying, but the burning of somebody used to be a public spectacle in most of what we call the developed world today every Sunday, because they would burn witches or they would burn heretics and they would make it hurt, and everybody thought that was perfectly normal. And we've now reached a state of development, which is far from perfect, but we all get horrified by that. So what ISIS is doing is just absolutely outside of today's norms. It was not outside the norms of what people were doing 3 centuries ago, 5 centuries ago. It's easy to forget that when you read the daily headlines.
Juan Enriquez is a managing director of XL Venture of the Harvard Business School Life Sciences Project, co-author of Evolving Ourselves, How Unnatural Selection and Non-Random Mutation Are Changing Life on Earth. Juan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Whoa, talk about context. Listen to this.
Hi, this is Deirdre from Glenwood Landing. I absolutely think our bodies need a certain amount of germs and allergens to be able to fight them off. When my kids were little and had their mouths on everything, an experienced mom told me to let them get plenty of vitamin D. And that D stood for dirt.
Has evolutionary biology got you down? Maybe it shouldn't. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.